Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and streaming live at KUCI.org. Today's show was recorded on December 4th, 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guest is literary agent Betsy Amster. Betsy is the president of Betsy Amster Literary Enterprises, a former editor at Random House. She's been described in the LA Times as a dogged prospector of the city's literary talent. Her clients include bestselling novelist Marisol Vera, I'm sure I've pronounced that wrong, but she can correct me when she's on, Maria Amparo Escandón, Joy Nicholson, MacArthur Fellow and urban farmer Will Allen, Beard Award winner and Portland baking goddess Kim Boyce, popular historian Margaret Leslie Davis, and best-selling research psychologist Elaine N. Aaron. Hi, Betsy.
Hi there.
You don't represent Barry Glasner, your husband?
No, I found him, his agent.
Were you ever his agent?
No, I'm really more his editor. You know, I'm the behind-the-scenes person.
Interesting. Okay. Is that just to sort of like doctors with their families, you know, they're not going to do surgery on a family member because they're too close, or?
Yes. Well, you want to be able to have enough distance from the situation that you can go, they're there. Yes, publishing can be frustrating, as opposed to tearing your hair out and going, how am I going to fix this?
Right. Okay. All right. I just had to ask you that. I don't know if I ever asked you if you were ever Barry's agent. But anyway, I'm going to assume that a lot of our listeners have not heard you on the show before. So maybe let's start with you talking a little bit about becoming an agent, you know, what you did before you became an agent and why you decided to go that way.
Well, I spent 10 years as an editor at Random House. I started as an assistant, as everybody did then, and worked my way up and saw publishing from the inside. And it's a really fascinating business. As an aside, in many ways, it hasn't changed, even though in many ways it has. And then became the editorial director of a small publisher in a barn in Connecticut called Globe Pequot. And then we moved out to California, and I decided to reinvent myself as an agent. And at that time, fortunately, it was very serendipitous. An agent in New York named Angela Miller asked me if I wanted to be kind of the development end for her of West Coast authors. And I did that for a couple of years, working really closely with Angela, and that was a really great way for me to get my feet wet and learn how to pitch editors and negotiate contracts and do and wrangle authors, for that matter. And then decided to strike out on my own. And it's, you know, where when you're inside publishing, there's always people you have to convince that a project is worth taking on. Certainly as an agent, you do the same thing, but you're not stuck with one cast of characters. So being able to take on projects that you love and then submit them broadly is a really fun undertaking.
Have you ever been a writer? Have you ever wanted to write? Because, you know, I remember when we were working on Pen on Fire, you just had so many great ideas, and you were such a great, you were a great editor, but it seems though that the way you use words, you would also be a wonderful writer. Was that ever something you wanted to do, or have you done that?
I used to write book reviews when I first moved to New York, for something called the Soho Weekly News, and also like for Ms. Magazine and Newsday and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, because I'm from Cleveland. That's not really writing in the same way. I have never really yearned to be a writer. I adore words. I love typefaces. I love holding books in my hands or reading them on a device, which I'm likelier to do now. I feel that I am a reader on steroids, and I'm amazed and really grateful that there's still a role for a reader on steroids. I think that publishing people tend to be really detail-oriented, but we also do have to be able to see the forest for the trees. And it's a kind of interesting, I wouldn't even call it tension. I feel that those two traits are very complementary. And being an agent draws on those for me. I think it's probably, I mean, here I am sitting alone in front of a computer, but it's probably a somewhat more social undertaking than being a writer. I think the kind of dedication that you have to a single project, it may simply come down to this. I get to spread among the many projects that I'm working on. Sometimes when I will speak, say, to college classes about what it's like being an agent, if you have a short attention span, I don't mean like an incredibly short attention span, but one where you like to be involved with many different subjects, being an agent is the perfect job.
And even now, I mean, with all the consolidation of publishers and I mean, well, let's talk about that. You know, just what does that mean for writers and for agents that, what just happened? Simon & Schuster was acquired by, will you tell me?
Well, Penguin Random House, theoretically, is buying Simon & Schuster. I say theoretically just because, will there be antitrust things? It seems like there probably won't be. I think Penguin Random House, I mean, you can already tell from the name, Penguin Random House, does a really great job allowing its various imprints and divisions to maintain a lot of independence. In certain circumstances, they will even bid against each other. I think it's an incredibly well-run organization. I've been struck working with them through the pandemic, how, you know, amazingly seamless it's been. Sometimes I forget the editors are not in the office and that everybody's all scattered around because things still happen when they're supposed to. That's actually been broadly true of publishers. The consolidation part is not fabulous in the sense of, you know, as publishers get bigger and bigger, it becomes harder and harder for the smaller ones to compete. And sometimes it's the smaller ones who are more of the risk takers. The risk-taking behavior, you can't count on the risk-taking behavior of the larger houses. I feel for the most part that I'm selling fewer books for more money, which sounds great, but sometimes you want to be able to launch somebody and that can be difficult because the risk-taking isn't always there. Now, I should say that this has been going on since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. I remember I've been in publishing for 100 years. And I remember in the 80s, there was an article in the New Yorker called The Blockbuster Syndrome. I don't remember who wrote it, but it was about the very thing that we're talking about now. The publisher's desire to publish books that are going to do incredibly well and not necessarily take a chance on things where they're unsure what might happen.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So will Penguin Random House have to change its name again?
That was my first question. What could it possibly be? I'm dying to know.
So, but how, I mean, like, you know, what does this mean though, in terms of, like you said, they'll, you know, imprints will bid against each other within the huge conglomerate. I mean, that's totally acceptable and encouraged, or is that something that?
Well, I haven't been in that situation with them. And my understanding of it is, and I hope this is up to date, is that a non-Penguin Random House imprint would have to also be involved, that the imprints would not simply bid against each other if there were not a Penguin Random, a non-Penguin Random House imprint involved. But I haven't tested that. I haven't been in that situation. Other house, I mean, Simon & Schuster, I have been in that situation. I've been in that situation with Chronicle. Oh, I know when I was in that situation. It wasn't Chronicle. It was actually Clarkson Potter and 10, no, can't remember what the other division was. But they ended up making a house bid, and then the author chose the division they wanted to go with. And that is also a common form of what happens when more than one imprint at the same house is interested, is it will come down to a house bid and then the author has some say.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, well, earlier you said that being an agent is more social than being a writer. And that's one of the reasons why you like that. But what about now? I mean, you know, we've been in this pandemic for 8-9 months, something like that. How has it affected what you do?
You know, less, it has affected me less than you would think. I'm still selling books. I'm still dealing with editors on books I've sold. I'm still negotiating contracts. A lot of it, I have often joked that I work for my computer. So, you know, a lot of that is still going on. And so you're still communicating with people about books. My author, Maricel Vera, had her book, The Taste of Sugar, which is a really wonderful novel that LiveWrite did, that is a piece of historical fiction that focuses on Puerto Rico, kind of at the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries, when the Americans took over and were thought to be the saviors and were quickly revealed not to be. The book came out this summer. We spoke with the LiveWrite folks about, gee whiz, should we be postponing this? The publicist wisely said, you know, I think there are going to be actually a lot of opportunities this summer. It turned out that that was the case, and Maricel got just a ton of review attention. And I'm not saying she wouldn't have gotten it ordinarily, but there was this feeling that many things had been postponed. There was a kind of hunger to focus on projects that people, you know, the reviewers loved. And so, you know, that made my summer. You know, I mean, seeing an author who has worked on a book for a very long time and really tried to perfect it and taken on something very ambitious and complicated. It's her second novel. And see her succeed in this very public way felt like a social undertaking, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. There was a cast of characters. You know, there was Ron Charles at the Washington Post. His review made me cry. The team at LiveWrite was phenomenal. You know, it was just one of those peak publishing experiences, and here it was going on during a pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, speaking of that, of doing a virtual launch and getting all these good book reviews, it really is kind of interesting how quickly it seems, how quickly we just got right into it, that, you know, there was a little bit of time of, you know, how's all this going to go? And then all of these literary events started online.
I know. It has made me very proud of publishing. Local writer John Boorstin once said to me that he thought publishing was a buggy whip business. And I love that. And I use it all the time. And strangely, the pandemic seems to be a moment for buggy whip businesses in some ways. You know, many of the things that seem to mark us as very old school somehow have stood us in good stead during the pandemic. You know, the fact that people want to read during the pandemic, for example, like how lucky is that?
Right. Right. What do you think? I mean, you know, say this goes away. Everybody's good again. We're back to normal. Can you see virtual events going on and book tours continuing that way?
You know, what's interesting about them is you can get a national audience. They're not local events necessarily, which is cool. I you know, it's like we've somehow gone past the space-time continuum onto Zoom. And it has weird and wonderful uses. I don't know. It beats me. I'm very curious about that, along with what Penguin Random House Simon & Schuster is going to be called. Those are the two things I'm most curious about.
Well, I'm also curious whether people buy books because of virtual events. I mean, I do because I get a lot of books sent to me from publishers for the show. But, you know, when I go to a virtual event, so often I want to buy a book just to support the bookstore that's putting on the event.
Right.
And I don't know if other people do that. If other people feel like, you know, it's up to us to keep these bookstores going. Do you know?
I don't know any stats. I can only give you an anecdote. And doesn't publishing turn on anecdotes? And the anecdote is about me. I listened to a Marilynne Robinson interview. I think it was Alexander Chi who did it for Penn. And it was really great. And the strand was the bookstore selling the book. And it was going to be, I thought it was so easy. You know, in other words, I simply had to press a few buttons and I got an autographed copy. I revere her. I think she's amazing. You know, an autographed copy of a book by an author I love. And there I was sitting at my desk. That would be really interesting to know stats on that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the turnout, you know, it was hundreds of people who were there. I guess in New York, perhaps hundreds of people would turn up at the Strand, but at most bookstores, I think that would be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've been, I mean, I'm sure you too. I've been at events where there's people from India and Australia and, uh-huh. You know, all sorts of places that these same people would never come for, most likely would never come for just, you know, 1 hour event with Marilynne Robinson, right? But here they are all over the world coming to these events. I'm curious. It'll be interesting to find that out someday.
Right. When we can look back.
When we can look back.
The ultimate luxury.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. I'm speaking with Betsy Amster, and her agency is Betsy Amster Literary Enterprises. So let's talk about you. Let's talk about what sort of books you represent and if there are dream genres or topics these days for you.
I'm interested in literary fiction. I'm looking for something head turning that's incredibly broad. Fiction is so subjective that it's difficult to, I find it difficult to articulate very well what I'm looking for. I do tend to like voice driven, sort of voice character place driven novels, perhaps even more than plot driven. I had the great pleasure this summer of selling my longtime author, Maria Amparo Escondón's mm-hmm. third novel, which is called LA Weather, to Flatiron. And she has a really distinctive voice. I met her through UCLA Extension Writers Program years and years ago. She has an amazing sense of the absurd, and she's writing this time about a prosperous Latino family in LA where the parents have been married for 40 years and announced to their daughters that they're going to get divorced and what ensues. that is an example. I mean, it's a setting that I really like. The characters are very vivid, and Maria has an utterly unique voice. I also really like narrative nonfiction. My author, Margaret Leslie Davis, had a book come out with Tercher Perigee called The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey, where she traced the different hands that one Gutenberg Bible passed through. In LA, it ended up in Estelle Doheny's hands, and then on from there. Mm-hmm. But it's a great yarn, and it's also about, over the centuries, the obsession that people have had with books, bibliophilia. So that to me is a perfect kind of book. I also really like research-based self-help. I've had really good luck in that category. I had a book come out this summer called Sugar Proof, The Hidden Dangers of Sugar That Are Putting Your Child's Health at Risk and What You Can Do, by Michael Gorin, who is at Children's Hospital in LA and also at the Keck School of Medicine at USC and is a specialist in obesity and diabetes in children. And Emily Ventura, who is an amazing PhD and has a master's in nutrition and or public health, I guess it is. Avery did that, which is part of Penguin Random House. You know, the feeling that a book can make a really significant difference in the reader's life or the family of the reader, I find that very intoxicating. And I'm not particularly interested in kind of inspirational books that exhort you. I'm really more interested in that category. I work with a lot of psychologists, for example, my author Elaine Aaron, who has a whole series of books that have done incredibly well worldwide on the trait of high sensitivity. Hmm. Citadel just did The Highly Sensitive Parent. She's got The Highly Sensitive Child, The Highly Sensitive Person in Love. And she and her husband, Arthur Aaron, have done a lot of research into the trait of high sensitivity and reframe it not as a deficit, but as an advantage. So, I mean, those are, I also like food and wine. My author, Terry Thies, has a book with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt called What Makes a Wine Worth Drinking in Praise of the Sublime. Hmm. A very literary take on what makes a wine worth drinking. So those are some of the books that I've done recently across many categories. Mm-hmm.
So will you ever see a project, either, you know, a query letter comes through or, you know, a manuscript arrives and you like it, or maybe you even love it, but it's not in maybe the categories that you tend to sell or have contacts for? Will you turn something like that down? Or if you like or love it, well, that is that enough and you'll find the contacts?
It can go both ways. You do feel a strong responsibility as an agent to give the author the benefit of real expertise. I have handled some commercial women's fiction, for example, that I loved, but it's not a category that I gravitate towards. So I'm probably more inclined to refer people. I want to give people positive feedback in that situation because writing can be so isolated. So I want to give them a very specific personal reaction and advice on finding an agent and that kind of thing. So occasionally I will kind of wander out of my categories. I mean, I have, like any agent, I have many categories that I like to operate in, and I haven't really gotten into all of them today. But I do also want to make sure that writers are in the best possible hands.
Speaking speaking of that then, of writers getting in touch and finding you, let's talk a little bit about the query letter, because it does seem that the query letter is where things begin, unless, you know, you said you met Maria Escandon at UCLA, and I don't know if she followed up with a query letter or if you knew her work so well at that point that you didn't have to go through that.
I don't remember. It's kind of lost in the mists. Yeah. In this case, kind of lost in the mists of time.
Sure, sure. But in terms of queries, do you think there's still basically, the format is still basically the same as it ever was? I mean, for, you know, the structure and what you need to know, or has that changed somewhat? Does that change?
I don't feel that it has changed really. I think it pays to be brisk. I think it pays to study some flap copy of existing books to see what publishers feel is important to bring to the attention of readers and try to write copy on your own behalf that way. And it's not that easy. But it's not impossible. Don't give the whole story away if we're talking about fiction. You know, when you're talking about your credentials and offering comps, basically books that are competing or comparable. Comparable is really more relevant when it comes to fiction. Competing is more relevant when it comes to nonfiction. You know, just helping to position your book for the agent. And there's a subtext to a good query letter too, which is that you are a reasonable person, you've done research, you think it's important to dot I's and cross T's, because believe me, it is really important in publishing. And then you want to pay attention to how the agent wants to be approached. I like to get, for anything narrative, I want to get the first three pages embedded in the email. For something like self-help, or I would like to get the whole proposal. But I will sort of zip through a cover letter and say to myself, yes, seems competent, has good connections, could get some quotes, you know, could get some blurbs, and then zoom on to the sample material. Because that's the heart of the matter, is what's the writing like?
So you mentioned could get blurbs. Do you want to hear from writers in a query letter that they're connected here and there, or you know?
Yes.
Yeah, you do.
It's handy. And sometimes you might be connected because you've taken a class, you know, with a published writer who has been supportive of your work. It's partly showing that you're in a network. There are all sorts of different ways of showing that you're in a network. It might be saying that you've taken classes at UCLA Extension, say, or you know, gone to various writers' conferences. Anything where you're saying, I'm taking this very, very seriously, is helpful. You would be surprised by the number of letters that every agent gets that say, you know, I'm taking this up in retirement. It's always been my dream, et cetera.
Right.
That doesn't move us, you know, it just doesn't. We need a more professional approach.
What about that first, the first paragraph? I mean, do you want to know right away how the writer came to find you, whether it's out of, you know, a book or a publisher's marketplace or a friend? I mean, is that important to you to know, to have that personalized?
If there's something legitimate to say, yeah, I mean, if you're getting a referral, that's important to mention. I do sometimes feel that people will study recent deals of mine on Publishers Lunch, the website, publishersmarketplace.com, and then will kind of regurgitate them to me. one of my readers said something to me. She found this very perplexing because she said, they're telling you something you know about yourself. So that's not always persuasive. I would rather be found in the acknowledgments to something, which would perhaps indicate that the person had read the book, as opposed to simply harvesting names of titles I've sold off of Publisher's Lunch, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But I don't mind if people just launch into what is their book about at all. That's also completely fine.
What about categories? I mean, do you want a writer to tell you, I've written, you know, a thriller of 60,000 words, or?
Yes, I think that kind of sort of housekeeping details, housekeeping details are really useful. One little purgatory that authors can get stuck in is not quite knowing what the category is for their book. And, you know, is it young adult or is it adult? That doesn't really so much have to do with the query letter, although the query letter does set certain expectations. You know, if you tell me that you're writing a novel for adults and I start reading it and it feels like it's a YA novel, that's kind of a problem. And it happens a fair amount.
What if you like it? What if you
I encourage writers that I like.
So if they get the category wrong, but you like what you're reading, you might overlook that?
Well, it's not that I'm going to overlook it. I work actually with somebody who handles picture books, middle grade, YA under my umbrella. Her name is Mary Cummings. And she used to be the education director at the Loft in Minneapolis, the Writers Center. And she works out of Minneapolis. YA is a category I'm not very good at evaluating because I don't read it. Mary is really good at it. And so I will send people to her, you know, if I feel that there's something really interesting about their writing, but it is not in fact something for an adult editor.
Hmm. So there was something I was going to ask you connected with that. Oh, you get a query letter. It looks interesting. Will you look the writer up? Will you go onto Facebook or Twitter or wherever and see, you know, who this writer is, how he or she handles themselves, what political party they're aligned with? I mean, all that kind of stuff. Or does that not matter if you're interested?
That's an excellent question. I will generally Google people. Occasionally I will go to Twitter. I don't think I've ever researched anybody on Facebook. I don't care. I mean, I don't want them to be a raving maniac, but I don't feel like I'm approached by raving maniacs that often. I don't care about views or anything like that. What I do want to know is whether the writer has gotten themselves out there. Especially if they're writers of nonfiction, where your platform, I'm sure you've talked about that ad nauseum with agents, but you know, where your platform is important. What I'm doing is simply doing what the editor is going to do. If I send them the material, they're going to Google the author. And if nothing comes up, that's not going to be good. So I don't like to get, I want to know in advance what the editor is going to encounter when they start doing their due diligence. So I do my due diligence.
You said you don't look people up on Facebook. Do you think Twitter is better for writers or a place to be, to, you know, be looked up on? I mean, does it matter? Or is it important just to have somewhere that you create a presence?
I think somewhere that you create a presence. Mm-hmm. I think Twitter has amazing reach, and that's great. Publishers have become somewhat more reasonable about what they expect from, I mean, they want you to be on social media for sure, but at the same time, they don't want you, they understand it's not going to be your job.
And does that go for fiction too? I mean, I can see why nonfiction would be, it would be more important to be out there, but it seems that, you know, a few years ago, it wasn't that important for fiction writers to have a platform. And now it's becoming increasingly important. Is that so?
All I can say is I don't feel particularly burdened by that. Mm-hmm. You know, on behalf of my authors.
Yeah. What about fiction versus nonfiction? Is it still that nonfiction sells better? And are women still buying more of the books? Are we more concerned with the female audience when it comes to fiction?
You know, I feel that I may have read, I have a dim memory of having seen something, stats about that during the pandemic. I cannot recall them for the life of me. I don't tend to worry about big trends. That's one thing I particularly like about being an agent, is that it's a very particular undertaking. I tend to be drawn to women novelists, both, I mean, not invariably, but probably 3/4 of what I read is written by women. And most of the novelists that I represent are women. So I'm just going for things that I love and respond to and can make a case for, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel that is the impetus for a lot of agents. We're selling our own enthusiasm. So I don't pay attention to some of the macro stuff because I know so much of it is happening on a micro level, on a particular book level, with a particular editor falling in love with a particular book. Yes. You know, that's the kind of alchemy I'm trying to create.
Will you seek out people? Will you go to literary journals or, you know, whatever you're reading and go, you know what, I want to see if this writer has an agent. And contact them?
I have done that in the past. I've had luck in certain circumstances. One of the first books that I represented was something called Good Bugs for Your Garden by Allison Starcher. And it's this adorable book that 4 publishers bid on. Algonquin ended up taking it. And it's about the bugs you don't want to kill in your garden. And it's done as an artist's sketchbook. And I had seen illustrations of hers in a Southern California gardening journal, and called her up and said, you know, I love these. Do you have a book in you? I haven't had, there are agents who really have made a career out of focusing on literary magazines and going after writers in them. I feel like for some reason, every time I've done that, it's the author's first published short story. Mm-hmm. And so I end up sort of getting off the phone or, you know, turning away from the email and going, well, I'll be hearing from them again in 20 years. That's just been my experience, though. Some people are really, really good at that.
What about, I know, you know, when you've been on before, you've talked about Publisher's Lunch as being, you know, the one publication writers who are looking for an agent or wanting to learn more about publishing should read. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I think he does a great job of aggregating useful information. It's very efficient.
It's such a great source in terms of looking people up too, or you want to know who what agent represents, you know, so and so author. Look it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's great, and actually Maricel Vera's editor at LiveWrite, I had not met before, but she just seemed like she would be, you know, she'd be interested in this novel, and I adore her. I think she's done an amazing job. But we met in person after, well, it was pre-pandemic, but, you know, after I sold her that book.
That's another thing. I mean, meeting writers, are there writers you represent that you've never met in the flesh?
Yeah, there are. Not so much on the West Coast, but I, for example, I have an author in Kentucky who writes very quirky novels, and I've never met him, and I love his work, but have never met him. We have never met.
Hmm. What about the other, I'm thinking of a couple of other online sites like Manuscript Wishlist and Query Tracker. Are they useful for writers, do you think?
I don't know. The really Publishers Lunch and Publishers Marketplace is kind of where I live, I would say. Mm-hmm. So I can't comment on that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is ageism. And I think we've talked about it before, I think for an article I wrote for the Authors Guild mm-hmm. Bulletin. I don't know if we've talked about it on the show, but what about ageism in publishing? Do you think it exists? Is it important for writers to, you know, have, you know, use pictures that are 20 years old? And
no, it is a bit of a dating service, meaning you want to find the right editor for your author. Maricel's editor is young. She fell in love with the work. That's the great thing about publishing, is they're not falling in love with you exactly. I mean, they are, that's part of it, but they're really falling in love with the work. So I don't feel that ageism is that big of a deal. There are some times when, you know, you're aware that you're cultural touchstones are not the same as a young editor's cultural touchstones, or, you know, even like the websites you turn to, or how you spend your time on your computer or your devices or whatever, you know, it's not identical, but that's all right. I think it's a fairly big tent industry.
Mm. And another agent said to me, I think I asked, you know, that's a similar question. She's like, well, most writers only have one book in them anyway. And so we want that one book.
It depends on the category. When you're working with experts, that's certainly true that they often only have one book in them. But when you're working with novelists, that is rarely true. You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've just, you know, I've thought about that ever since she said that. I'm like, yeah. Okay.
Well, it is true in certain categories.
Right. Rejection letters, authors mm-hmm. hearing from agents. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you about, you said you have a reader mm-hmm. and how do you train a reader to know what you're looking for, what you love? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I try to train them to run things by me so they don't accidentally, you know, so they err on the side of caution. I've been fortunate that my readers over the years have always found me a new reader when they decided they weren't going to do it anymore. That happened recently again. And to some extent, the previous reader trains the new reader. And then I and the new reader have a kind of dialogue where I'm explaining why something's not going to work. Because when you're giving things the benefit of the doubt, 9 times out of 10, it's not going to work out. Or, you know, it could be 99 out of 100. And that whole dialogue is really interesting and kind of fun. Because it isn't self-evident. It is something that you have to learn. I remember learning it as a young assistant, you know, over time. So I basically it's a screening process. And then I also want a reader to be able to work with me on writing very encouraging rejections in the cases where we are taking the time to respond personally.
Yeah, and that's actually what I wanted to ask you about, because rejection letters, you know, they range from what looks like a boilerplate, sorry, mm-hmm. This isn't for me, to, you know, I didn't connect with the main character, or I didn't get the setting, or I didn't get the voice. I mean, how should writers interpret rejection letters? I mean, obviously a form probably, you know, there's nothing to do with that. You know, there's no way to know anything other than it wasn't for the agent. But, you know, what about other variations? You get a note, somebody sounds as if, the agent sounds as if they did read the book, or read the 50 pages, or read the first chapter.
I think writers should respond in a similar way to the way agents respond when they get rejection letters from editors, which is look at the range of them. Some of them are going to be boilerplate. Some might be very short, but there's a kind of kernel in there of, I do believe the person really looked at it. And then if you get encouraging rejections that perhaps give you a sense of where the material falls short, take those seriously. To some extent, you can dismiss the ones that are boilerplate. If you only get a whole bunch of boilerplate rejections, that's not great, because it seems to suggest that the material didn't break through. But if you do get some personal ones, I would just forget the boilerplate ones and really focus on the ones that seemed to react to the work.
And I've heard this question posed to agents on panels recently, and that is, when is it okay to resubmit a work to an agent that they rejected, that they said, you know, love this, didn't love this? I mean, do you only want to do that if they encourage you to do that, to resubmit? Yes. If you revise? Okay.
I try to be as clear as possible. You know, I say, if you decide you're willing to attempt a substantive revision, I'd love to see it again. You know, I don't want to be ambiguous about that.
Does that often work out or no?
Well, it tends to be difficult to resubmit. Sometimes people don't understand how much things have to be transformed. Mm-hmm. So you feel that you're reading the same thing that's been gently tweaked, and gently tweaked is not what I'm looking for.
Right.
But I've, you know, with novelists that I've worked with, I've often seen work undergo massive revision, because revision is the name of the game. So I don't think it's impossible. It just has to be really considerable and organic, usually.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot, and I'm sure there's more we could cover, but we're out of time. So do you have any sort of, what we always do at the end of the show, any last words or advice for the writers listening?
Two things. One is, persistence is key. So having a certain amount of stamina and kind of, you know, you may get rejected, but pick yourself up and try again is really useful. Often it is the difference between failure and success. And the other is not to write in complete isolation. Here in LA, I think UCLA Extension's writers program is really great. And there are other writing groups that you can join, but making sure that you have an audience and understand the effect of your work on your audience is just an important step to take in making sure that your work is as good as it can be.
Yeah. If somebody's worked with a developmental editor, do you want to hear that?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it works to your advantage. It would be better that, you know, there's some really great groups, especially in New York, of former editors. And if one of them wrote me and said, I worked with this writer whose work I think is fantastic, that would be the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay.
So thank you for asking such good questions, Barbara. Well,
thank you for taking the time to be on the show again. Thank you, Betsy.
You are quite welcome.
That was Betsy Amster. Her agency is Betsy Amster Literary Enterprises. You can find her online and Publishers Lunch and all over the place, and someday in person. And I've been Barbara DeMarco Barrett all this time as well. Thank you all for listening, and have a good and safe week. Thank you. Thank you.
letters on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. Hey.